Consider buying your processed oboe and bassoon cane from those friendly folks over at Barton Cane. Processed with care and precision for your everyday reed making needs. Take the pain and injury out of reed making by letting Barton Cane do the hard, repetitive, boring stuff. Free up time for practicing, happy hours, hikes, baking, and spending time with friends and family. Barton Cane, here for you. Visit www.bartoncane.com.
Specializing in the finest assortment of oboes, clarinets, bassoons, and their accessories, RDG Woodwinds serves musicians around the world. Their employees are all professional musicians who have a deep knowledge of the products that they sell. RDG's repair shop has an international reputation with a combined 100 plus years of service among the five repair technicians. Plain and simple, RDG provides excellent products and fabulous customer service. Visit them at rdgwoodwinds.com. They look forward to working with you.
Hi, I'm Galit Kaunitz.
And I'm Jackie Wilson. And you're listening to Double Reed Dish,
a podcast for oboists,
bassoonists,
and the people who love them.
Oh my gosh. You're surrounded by boxes. The listeners cannot see. You are surrounded by boxes, and I suspect duct tape, Sharpie markers.
I got the packing tape right
here. Oh, packing tape. Yes.
The markers are somewhere.
Do you have some news to share, Galit?
I have really big news. I have accepted the oboe job at Colorado State University.
Obviously, I knew that already.
Okay, I said it like in a range that only squirrels can hear, so I'll say it again. I accepted a job at Colorado State University, and we are moving to the Fort Collins area.
Soon. Your house lists the day this episode comes out.
That's right.
So if you're in the area and want to buy Galit's house,
let me know if you want to buy my house. Yeah, we've been sitting on a secret for a little while, but it feels good to finally share it. This is old news if you like follow me on social media, but this is a big, big change, and Becky and I are really excited.
Absolutely. And me, I'm excited too, because listen, it used to be quite the ordeal getting to each other, especially once I moved. When I was in Missouri and you were in Mississippi,
I wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also, as I'm talking through this, I'm realizing how much you come to me. I very rarely go to you.
You came to me once.
Once.
How many times did I go to your house in Missouri? Four? Three?
Quite a few times, especially because you were driving up to see people north and it was a very convenient stopping point.
It was literally halfway. So it was you were being generous by allowing me to stay the night is what happened.
But then when I came out here, you've been out here several times. And
yeah.
I have not been out there. But listen. Now, like, we know because we were just at the Colorado State Double Reed Day, the trip from Pullman to DIA is less than 2 hours, easily achievable with miles.
Listen.
Come on. I'm so excited. Like, we
are already planning just like a day trip, just like a weekend where we go see each other, hang out, go do some thrift shopping, go to some
Absolutely.
Coffee shops. Chris is going to grill some steaks and I'm going to clink my empty glass at him.
Yes. And we can do it now because you're close enough. You're not on the other side of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Just a short plane ride.
I will say that it is bittersweet because we have lived in Hattiesburg for 9 years and I've worked at USM for 9 years, and those are some deep roots to pull, but you know, my students, my colleagues, the playing opportunities that I've had out here, like I wouldn't be who I am without all of those things. So I'm so deeply appreciative for the experience that I've had here. And I'm going to miss everyone a lot, so much. We had our last studio class yesterday and I was just like, all right, let's wrap it up. Time to go before I start crying. So yeah, it's like that feeling of like, wow, we're so excited for what is coming and we're so grateful for what we had, and especially for the relationships, you know, like musicians are a bit nomadic in our lifestyle. Like you just kind of go where you have an opportunity and you don't sometimes get to choose where that is. And you just hope that it's a friendly place and that, you know, you'll have success and you will be accepted by the people who are there. And that's totally been our experience here. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful chapter.
And it's about to be over so you can be closer to me. West is best, baby.
We are so excited. Like I'm from Connecticut, obviously, and Becky's from Michigan. So we are very excited for cooler weather and mountains and
arid, no humidity, like beautiful views. I'm the ambassador of the West. I feel like it's the greatest place on earth. So I'm very excited for you to get the experience of living in this part of the country, because I personally
think
it's
the best. I've never lived in the West.
I mean, I think the Pacific Northwest is the best, but you Colorado's okay.
Close enough. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I've lived on the East Coast. I've lived in New England. I've lived in the Upper Midwest. I've lived in the Southeast. I've lived in, what does Texas count as?
Texas is Texas.
I've lived in Texas.
The nation of Texas.
This is my first time living in the West.
It's the best. You're going to love it.
I'm going to love it. Yeah.
And so this summer we will get to hear the hopefully not too harrowing tale of selling a house, getting moving across the country with three gigantic dogs, relocating after 10 years. And I'll get to watch from the comfort of my life where I'm not doing that.
Well, I got to watch from the comfort of my life while you were doing that.
So. In the middle of COVID.
Yeah.
If you remember, I moved summer 2020, which hindsight is just bananas. With a geriatric basset hound in the middle of COVID from Missouri to Washington State. What were we thinking? Such a wild ride. But you're going to have so much fun. And the school year is almost over, so we can focus on that.
I mean, talk about senioritis.
Oh, I can only imagine.
Listen, we're in the last week of classes right now. Next week is juries. We have a faculty meeting on Thursday. I'm like, do I need to go to the faculty meeting?
Oh, you got to skip it. I'm such an enabler. Like, don't go. Come on. No,
I don't even have to go to this faculty meeting.
No way. But you know, if they don't go, they'll be like, and now a goodbye gift and a round of applause for Gala. She's not here. She skipped.
Has anyone seen her? No? No?
So yeah, maybe you better go.
I probably should go just in case.
ACDC Reads is a one-woman bassoon reed workshop in Minnesota run by Dr. Ariel Detweiler, producing over 1,500 reeds per year. Selling beginner bassoon reeds, advanced bassoon reeds, and contrabassoon reeds, ACDC Reads are hailed by customers for their even intonation, ease of response in all registers, warm tone quality, and strong low register. Every reed is made from tube cane processed in-house to Ariel's specifications using Rigotti or Lavaro cane and a Rieger 1A shape. You'll also find bassoon-themed gifts in the shop, including greeting cards, stickers, artistic prints, and the ever-popular Black Wing bassoon pencil. Make sure to follow ACDC Reads on Instagram, where Ariel posts artistic photos and educational stories about her everyday experiences with reed-making. ACDC Reads is a proud sponsor of Double Reed Dish, sharing positive and uplifting interviews to inspire and connect the bassoon community around the world. Find ACDC Reads at www.acdcreads.com or at retailers like Chemical City Double Reeds, Midwest Musical Imports, or Reed Supplies Canada. Try out ACDC Reads today and let the reed do the work.
Chemical City Double Reeds is a full-service double reed shop specializing in the sale of instruments, cane, accessories, and sheet music. Double Reed Dish listeners can enjoy free shipping with code DRDISH. Visit them in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, or online at www.chemicalcityreeds.com.
We are delighted to welcome to Double Reed Dish, Allison Nicotera, Assistant Professor of Bassoon at the University of Kentucky. Welcome to Double Reed Dish.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
We love to start our interviews by asking our guests how they came to play their instruments. So could you start out by telling us how you got your hands on a bassoon?
Yes, I can. At the time that I started playing bassoon, I lived in a suburb of Dallas, Texas, and I was going into middle school, and I knew I wanted to be in band. And as it happens in Texas, you have to interview with the band director before the school year begins. So this was before the beginning of my sixth grade year. I had to go in for an interview with the band director to decide which instrument I would play, you know, to decide my fate. And I went in with my mom over the summer before I started sixth grade, and my top three choices were clarinet, flute, and percussion. And so he let me try the clarinet, and I was terrible. And he looked at me and he said, "You don't look like a flute player," which whatever that means. And he said, "Oh, and to play percussion, you have to have at least 2 years of piano experience, because remember, this is Texas, and they can make such demands of their middle school instrumentalists." And I did, in fact, have some piano experience. I took piano lessons starting at age six, which I said, and I was about the same height that I am now when I was this 11-year-old. 5'7", so I was pretty tall as an 11-year-old.
Oh my goodness.
And so he looked at my mom and he's like, "How are her grades?" Which we know now is not the way to pick a bassoonist, but he asked her. And upon receiving the answer he wanted, went rummaging around under his desk, and I heard all the banging and clanging, and up he came with the bassoon fully assembled. And he said, "I think that you should play this." And so I was voluntold to play the bassoon. I never looked back, to be honest. I didn't disagree. And I took it home that day and made my first sounds, and the rest is history.
Wow.
So when did you start to think that maybe the bassoon was something that you wanted to either, you know, be serious about and very dedicated to? Did that come early? And when were you thinking, yeah, college or pursuing it as a career? When did that start to become part of the plan?
Yeah, I think that honestly, from those first notes that I played on the bassoon, I knew that there was something there. I did not have this fully formed idea in my mind of I am going to be a professional bassoonist when I played open F, and it probably was not even an F. but I think the college seed was planted in that meeting with the band director at that middle school meeting, because he told my mom, well, she could probably get a scholarship to college on the bassoon. Mm-hmm. So that was always kind of in the back of my mind. And I always so enjoyed playing music with my peers and being in band and doing all those extracurricular music activities like youth orchestra, that I really just never saw another path There are other things in life that I enjoyed, but I never saw myself pursuing another real path except music, starting from the time I was in high school.
So talk us through your training and educational journey and how you got to where you are today at the University of Kentucky.
I just said, really knew that I wanted to do this music thing, but that doesn't mean that I had very good practice habits and knew what it would take to get into a college program that I wanted to study in. So when I was still in middle school, my family actually moved from Texas to Connecticut. And there in Connecticut, the middle school did not own 6 Fox bassoons. Imagine, like they did in Texas. My parents graciously bought me my first bassoon. It was a Fox 240 when I was in eighth grade. And that's when I started taking real serious lessons. So I studied with a couple different teachers in Connecticut in high school. I did youth orchestras. I played in the Bridgeport Youth Orchestra and in the New Haven Youth Symphony.
I played in that one too.
Oh, nice.
I grew up in Connecticut too.
Yeah. So you know the spots. I did everything I could possibly do on the bassoon and in high school, even down to playing in my high school jazz band some trombone parts on the bassoon.
Cool.
But I still was a high school bassoonist. I had some things to work on. And I didn't really have anybody telling me fundamentals, or maybe I did and I wasn't listening. That's probably more likely. But I got to the end of high school and I auditioned to all of these collegiate music programs that I had heard were good programs. And out of 10 auditions, I got rejected at 9 institutions and waitlisted at 1. So this was my senior year of high school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, looking back, I think the amount of fortitude that it took for me to move past that and then to continue on this path was probably a little bit beyond my years then as a 17-year-old. So I took a year off after I graduated mm-hmm. high school. I did eventually get into this one school that I was waitlisted at, but I'm a very stubborn person. And so I decided I could do better. So I took a year off and I worked a little bit to make some money. I think I worked at Target. And I took lessons and I continued practicing. I continued to play with the New Haven Youth Symphony. They let me stay on after I graduated mm-hmm. high school, which is great. I played in chamber music ensembles in New Haven as well. And at the end of that year, I'm happy to say that I got into several different collegiate music programs. And I decided to attend the Hart School of Music, where I did my bachelor's in bassoon performance. I studied with Mark Goldberg there. And I had a really excellent time at that school. There were only a handful of bassoonists while I was there. So it was really an experience of being thrust into this world of constant playing. I think we have better words for that now. And I probably experienced some burnout while I was there. Mm-hmm. But we didn't talk about that at the time that I was doing my degree there. So it was a heavy kind of program. I was playing all the time in all sorts of different ensembles. And I credit a lot of my ability to learn on the fly to that degree and that program there. So I really learned a lot of the repertoire while I was there because I was playing in almost every ensemble. After I was done at the Hart School, I auditioned for master's programs and had some good luck and also worked hard, I'll say, and ended up attending the Juilliard School for my master's degree. I studied with Trish Rogers there. At the time, she was still principal at the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. And those were an intensive few years as well for many different reasons. It was more, how can we improve on your fundamentals so that you're not just a bassoonist who can sight read something that we throw in front of you, because that's how you had to learn to play in ensembles during your undergrad. But how can we really learn the orchestral excerpt requirements, and how can we make you a more versatile player in that way? And after I finished my master's degree, I ended up staying in New York City and freelancing for 6 years. I thought maybe I was done with school. I lived and worked in New York, and I was happy and played in all sorts of different ensembles. You name it. I mean, what freelancers do. I taught lessons. I worked full time at a music bookstore for a while. And then one day after I turned 30, I think I just had this like itch in the back of my mind somewhere, that I wanted to move on a little bit from this freelancer's life. I was tired of living in a tiny apartment. I wanted to expand a little bit. It's this thing that happens to people when they get older. They're like, I really want to do some home improvement projects. and so I started thinking about ways that I could leave New York, and getting a doctorate was one of them. Mm-hmm. So I auditioned a few places and ultimately decided to go to the University of Michigan to do my DMA. I studied with Dr. Jeff Lyman there. And talk about a wealth of knowledge. That was where I really felt the culmination of all of my study come together, because it wasn't just playing, even, you know, it was very playing focused. It was a DMA and bassoon performance, but it wasn't just playing. It wasn't just academics. It wasn't just pigeonholing myself into one area of the bassoon. It was exploring anything and everything to do with the bassoon, developing my own ideas about pedagogy, and anything in between, you name it. I think that Jeff Lyman knows it. And so that's where I finally found my passion for pedagogy, really, was during my doctoral program. Mm-hmm. Let's see. So during my doctoral degree, actually in my, I think it was the second semester of my first year was 2020. So this is when the pandemic began. So most of my academic coursework was actually completed online in Zoom format. I took all of my preliminary exams and comprehensive exams over Zoom, which I hope we never have to repeat. That was, we learned a lot and of what can be accomplished on Zoom during that time. And I think that comprehensive exams are not one of them. And it was a great chance to really just dive into my own practice and my own reed making and everything in between there with regards to learning the bassoon and furthering my knowledge of this instrument that I loved so deeply, but I didn't have this really firm footing in knowledge of, I think, until I got to my doctoral program. And so it was during my third year of, actually the right before my third and final year of my DMA, that I had a baby right before my third year of that program. So I took a semester of leave so that I could, you know, learn how to raise a child, learn how to be a parent. And I went back for the second semester of that program and created, I went back for the final semester of my DMA to complete all of my degree requirements. So all of my recitals, and again, those comprehensive exams I did in the second semester of my third year of study there. Mm-hmm. And that was the trajectory that I needed to set in place that momentum to then go on the job market. Mm-hmm. So it was during that second semester when I was doing all of my recitals, I was doing my oral exams and defending that my dissertation recitals, that I was applying for jobs and ended up getting several Zoom interviews and then a few on-campus visits, and was invited to the University of Kentucky to have an interview, play a recital, give a masterclass, all of the things that we do in higher education searches. And I was lucky enough to be offered the job here. And here I am in Lexington, Kentucky.
So we have a couple of directions we could go, but let's start with you talked about how, you know, the end of your degree and that hyper-focused concentrated time really prepared you for interviewing and applying for higher ed jobs. Could you talk to us about some of the things that you learned in that process and just kind of general advice for listeners who are on the higher ed job market?
Sure. I think that first and foremost, being yourself is so important in these kind of situations. There's no point in trying to be who you think the committee wants you to be, because inevitably, if you get that job, you're going to have to work with these people every day. Mm-hmm. So being genuine, being, you know, who you are is important. I think too that I realized over the course of applying for jobs and interviewing for jobs that it's really easy to sell ourselves short in what we've accomplished in life. So while I might have been in a doctoral program and it might have looked like I wasn't experienced as a performer or as an educator, I had all this back experience while I was living and working in New York City mm-hmm. that I was able to pull from. And I think it's easy for people to forget what they've done when they're comparing themselves to others. So those are kind of some broad points. As it concerns applying to jobs, having a good CV, having a good set of materials ready to go, having good recordings at the ready, and a one-page resume in addition to your, you know, multi-page CV, really well fleshed out and thoughtfully considered, goes a really long way with a search committee. I just completed my first service on a search committee and revamped my CV because of it. Mm-hmm. And being attentive and responsive to emails is that other one. I tell my students this all the time. Like, there is no greater gift you can give yourself than learning how to write an email. So important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I remember the first time serving on a search committee and being like, oh, I wish I could apply for a job again, because I get it now. I get it way different now. As you're going through your trajectory, you outlined all these different experiences that you had, including that period after high school where you kind of went to the woodshed to, you know, really have that dedicated time, which, as you acknowledged, and I agree, was a very resilient response to disappointment that, especially at such a young age, and disappointment is inherent to what we do. And so I wonder how, I don't know if you have any thoughts you'd want to give in terms of like expanding on that, or I'm really curious as to how it informs your teaching. So I don't know if that's not really a question. That's kind of, but do you have a response to my non-question?
Yeah, I think I can go in a direction with this. So I think that we are told as musicians and just as busy people in general to learn how to say no, but nobody ever talks to us about how to hear no, and how to move past hearing no. And it's really easy to get caught up in the comparison. You know, the saying comparison is the thief of joy. I think this is really true in music, because we see our peers and our colleagues having success, and it can feel as though we are not having that success, but probably somewhere there's somebody thinking, oh wow, that colleague who is you is having so much success. So I think that not getting into the trap of comparing ourselves is important. Focusing on one's own strengths can be really beneficial. But learning how to hear no means that you have to put yourself out there. So that's how I kind of talk to students about this, is that you won't hear no unless you try. But once you do start trying, of course you will hear no. So I'm really honest with them about the things that are happening in my professional life that I'm hearing no to. You can apply for 10 grants and hear no from all 10 of them very easily. It's almost expected that you'll hear no from all of them. Same thing with reads. I mean, I can make 10 blanks and all 10 of them are going to tell me no when I go to clip them open. But I think being honest with them about my own professional no's is important. And also persevering through them by example is just as important. So if they're applying to summer festivals and they hear no, I remind them that, yes, I once applied to a summer festival and heard no. Mm-hmm. And in putting ourselves out there and hearing no, we choose to be resilient and we choose to keep trying.
That's such an important point, and it frames it in such a way that it is a privilege to be rejected and it's a privilege to be told no, because it means that you're trying.
Yeah, I like that.
My question to follow up what you were talking about with your freelance career and then going into your doctorate is, it is such a special skill set to build a freelance career, especially over a long period of time. I feel like in freelance world, 6 years is a long time. So what standards of professionalism that you learned from that time do you then impart to your students? What was important to you and what did you learn at that time?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I will repeat, learn how to write a good email. This is important in academia, in freelance life, in all aspects of life. I think just learning how to reply to an email is really important, and how to craft an email too. Mm-hmm. In terms of performance at these gigs is what they are. Never sight read. You know, unless something is given to you at the gig, never show up unprepared. It's imperative to put your best self forward and your best performance out there every single time you pick up the bassoon or the instrument that you're playing. Making sure that you are kind of versed with what's happening in the city that you live in is important. While I was in New York, I started subbing on Phantom of the Opera, which was a really amazing experience. And there's almost nothing that prepares you for what it's like to play a Broadway musical for the first time, if you haven't maybe done it in high school or something. But knowing who to talk to and who to ask what the protocol was and things like that, made me feel a little bit more comfortable when I went in for my first show, because you can't rehearse this thing. It's a live show happening, you know, 8 times a week. There's no rehearsal anymore. The rehearsals were the 1980s.
Right. That's true. Everyone's been playing. They've played that show 10 million times.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. And yeah, the person who had the bassoon chair, the show has since closed, unfortunately, but she had been there since the first show.
Oh my God.
And could play it with the book closed. Yeah. Very impressive. but I think being well-versed with the culture of the city that you're in and the, you know, the way the ensembles run themselves is another point that we don't think about very often, but maybe there are things to know before you get there.
Yeah. Switching gears a little bit, can we talk about reads and also read making habits? We love to talk about the geeky stuff, like the shape you use and, you know, your style and all that stuff. Type of stuff, but also, like, I don't know, tips and tricks and how you approach your read making life and that type of thing.
Yeah. I think I don't know if this is unique or not. Maybe people don't talk about it, but I don't feel like I ever got real instruction from a pedagogue on read making. My teacher during my undergrad was an adjunct professor, so I was only there one day a week, and so, you know, put all the lessons into one day, and he was excellent, but we just didn't have time for read making. Every once in a while we'd have a studio class where we talked about, you know, broad topics in read making, and then I went to, you know, I got by trying to do it on my own. I figured it out, but went to my master's degree and same thing. You know, my teacher was a full-time orchestral musician, so we made reads together when we could, but it wasn't an immersive experience. And then I freelanced, so I don't feel like I really learned how to make a read until I was in this freelance life, and I had to, because I had to have reads. So I think this is something that all students can learn from, and all, you know, young musicians and maybe even all professionals can learn from. Don't be afraid to ask your friends for help, your colleagues for help. I would have bassoon friends over to my apartment in New York, and we would make reads, and I would ask, hey, what do you do during this step of the process? And we would just make reads together. Maybe we'd play some duets later, or trios, depending on how many people could fit in my tiny little apartment. And I would learn from them. So I feel like I learned read making by osmosis a little bit. And have continued to learn read making by osmosis. I'm a big fan of YouTube videos on read making and learning how to gouge cane. Nobody ever taught me how to gouge cane. Maybe this is taboo, I don't know. But
it sounds really similar to how I learned how to make reads.
Yeah. Yeah. Learning how to gouge cane for the first time, you know, and just figuring out what works for me and what doesn't. So it's been a process of elimination. And now that I've made all of those mistakes, I can impart some wisdom on my students. So I do teach read making classes here, and we do one-on-one. Read lessons, unless schedules don't allow for that. So it's like an additional lesson every week. Because everybody learns at such different rates, I feel like this is what people need, unless schedules don't allow, obviously. So each student kind of can approach it at their own pace of progress. So I teach, you know, one particular approach to read making, but I'm even hesitant to share what it is, because I think that read making is not a one size fits all thing. There are so many right ways to make a read, but there's only one way to learn how to do it, and that's to make reads. To practice making reads.
That's a hard one for a lot of students.
Well, it's cost prohibitive, and it's,
yeah, you just like go try it.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, I do have a method in which I teach reads, and I have an instruction, you know, page which they can follow. But at the end of the day, if they're doing something different that works for them, I'm never going to tell them no.
Do you teach them to make reeds from the tube, or do you do GSP, or is that dependent on degree path, or how do you approach that?
I start everybody with GSP, and then depending on which semester of study they're in reed making, they can progress or graduate to gouged cane and then tube cane.
Okay, cool.
I do teach it all.
Yeah, I definitely experienced what you described. It sounded like Galit did too, where in my doctorate, I had a very intensive reed pedagogy experience, but I remember being like, oh God, where would I be without it? Because for the first 2 degrees, it's my job to teach you music. It's my job to teach you the bassoon. Reeds, go figure it out. I can't be bothered.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's really common.
Yeah, I think so too.
What is your relationship to performance anxiety? It seems like as a freelancer and a student in these really big time major schools, you probably, I'm assuming and guessing that you maybe had to confront those feelings, and how have you managed them over time?
Yeah. I won't pretend they haven't gone away. I still deal with performance anxiety. I think during, even starting in high school, during youth orchestra concerts and things like that, there's a certain feeling that I get, and that I think most of us get when a solo is approaching in the repertoire. You know, a heightening of the senses in a way. And so, yeah, I've struggled with performance anxiety. I tend to be a person who gets nervous more after a performance than during a performance. It's an odd phenomenon, but I feel all those same feelings of nervousness after a performance and leading up to a performance, I guess. In the moment, I think, this wasn't something inherent to me. I did take a class while I was at Juilliard on performance anxiety. And I think, and I've read a bunch of the books, right, that are prescribed for performance anxiety. And I think that this idea of confronting the feeling of nervousness and acknowledging it and then telling it to go away in your head are pretty powerful, but it's something that has to be practiced. It's not something that you can just do once and say, oh, I did it, now I'll never be nervous again. I still struggle with this idea of performance anxiety and the feelings that accompany it. But I think that as I've had more life experiences, I realize that what happens in the moment of a performance is just one little blip on the radar. It's not going to make or break me as a performer. There can be some unfortunate accidents that happen, you know, over the course of a solo or a recital or whatever it is that I'm playing. We hope that those don't happen. But if they do, it's live music. I think that acknowledging them and moving on from them are ways to move past these mental blocks that we can get as performers and the feelings that we're not good enough.
Your answer reminds me of something that we've been talking about in woodwind pedagogy lately, which is we're reading the book Hidden Potential by Adam Grant. And he talks about our relationship to perfectionism and how it can help to, instead of thinking it has to be perfect or it's worthless, to think about what would be the minimal lovable product. And that sounds really similar to what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think so. And it's interesting to think about perfectionism in music, because we grow up hearing these mixed and mastered recordings that have no flaws. And so we have live performances and we think, oh my gosh, like, I'm never going to be that good as these recordings that we've heard. But I've been like revamping some of my online presence recently, and I have some videos up on YouTube. And in listening to them, I'm actually so pleased with how they sound, and I remember not being happy with them at the time that they were recorded, and now looking back, I can remember where I was in life and think, oh my gosh, I'm so proud of myself for accomplishing that performance under those circumstances, or whatever it is. So I think these life experiences are really important, and our students are younger, and they don't have all of these life experiences right. yet, but they will. And I think that reminding them that they will grow into themselves as performers is important.
Mm-hmm. I remember, really yeah, I remember when we interviewed Aaron Hill, he said, the recording is never as good as you remember, but it's also never as bad as you remember. Like yeah. whatever your extreme perception is, it's not quite that. But as you were talking, I was kind of thinking about like, you know, yeah, having this perspective, you're on the tenure track. You mentioned that you had, you became a mother near the end of your doctorate. So I'm wondering about, work-life balance and that perspective and balancing responsibilities in life and, you know, being dedicated to an instrument and having a career and everything. Kind of what's your approach to that experience?
I'm wondering about work-life balance too.
Is it a myth?
It is. Well, I think that, so if we can accept that as musicians, we are always going to take our work home with us in a way. I think if we accept that, it's easier to move past the myth of work-life balance. But in some ways, having the responsibilities of motherhood help me to create that work-life balance because I can't tell my 2-year-old, no, I cannot put you to bed right now. You know, I have to write an email. She's not going to listen. So yeah, I have to think about what I have to do every day in a more regimented way than I think I did before I became a parent. And it does help me organize it into categories a little bit better, the things I have to do every day. That's not to say that we should all have kids so we can become better organized people. It's not, it doesn't work that way, I promise. It just happened. That happened to be an added benefit for me. I think having a little kid too is so... it's some comedic relief from time to time of the stresses of work. Having to perform at a high level, having to pursue and, you know, complete all of the requirements that come with being on the tenure track in a job can get really heavy. So being able to finish my day of teaching and writing emails and then go home and play Legos and blow bubbles is really relieving. I wouldn't say I'm not a stressed out person though. So I think that you know, there's just some more behind the scenes that I have to figure out in this way with work-life balance. I think it's always a work in progress.
But you are doing it. And I think that's important. And it's something that we've always kind of teetered on in terms of the podcast, because on the one hand, I have had colleagues, especially senior colleagues, say, no one tells you you can do it. Like, I never saw, especially the generation kind of above me professionally, it's like you didn't see women having families and having careers. And it's very important that we model for the especially our women students who are up and coming, that you can have a career and you can do this. And there are mothers who are exemplary bassoonists and exemplary professors. On the other hand, it's like, you know, when we interview such and such dude, you know, do these things organically come up and do we pursue them, you know? So it's like, yeah. We know people want the modeling, but also like, we don't want to like talk to you for 40 minutes of your interview about being a mom. But I think it is, you know, important to note that like you are doing it and you got this job as a mother, as a new mother, and you're doing this tenure track journey as a new mother. And I think that's really cool for our listeners to get to experience and hear about for sure.
Yeah. Thanks. I appreciate that. And I think that I would agree. It is important to be the change that we want to see. Right. I think it's still the case many places that we just don't talk about it, about the how hard it is to do something. So I think, I kind of lost the thread here, but
we do tend to just shine up the shiny parts and push the hard parts under the rug and just say no. It's all great. It's all great.
Yeah. The facade.
Do you have any hidden gems of the repertoire that you love to play or teach that you could share with us?
Yeah. I don't know if this is a hidden gem per se. But I love using the Vivaldi cello sonatas on bassoon. They're a little bit more accessible than the concerti, and they're mostly, they translate pretty well to bassoon. They're just so stunningly beautiful, and they're nice to use in a duo setting as well because of the basso lines are so nice.
Ooh.
So they're a good pedagogical tool for intonation. And then for starting to get a little bit more adventurous in terms of technique on the instrument. I don't know if that's a...
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. Could we hear about a favorite memory of a past performance?
Yeah, sure. I think I have so many memories of performances during my time in New York City. But I think the one that sticks with me the most is that first Phantom of the Opera Broadway pit subbing musician experience, because there's almost no preparation for it, and it's the closest thing I think I've ever had to an out-of-body experience, because you have listened to this thing 1,000 times in preparation, played along with the recording and all of that, but then you're there and you're the one doing the thing. So it's special to be able to feel accomplished in that way when you complete a performance. I think too. Sorry, I have two.
Yeah, go for it.
It's not even a performance. It was a dress rehearsal for one of my dissertation recitals when I was at the University of Michigan, and my daughter was only 4 months old, and my husband brought her to the dress rehearsal of my first dissertation recital.
That sentence is kind of wild. You're gonna blast through it, but it's kind of wild that you just said that. But go ahead. I just want to acknowledge that's kind of a wild sentence. But okay, go for it. Yes, 4 months postpartum, you were right. Finishing your
about to give
degree.
My first dissertation recital. Out. Yeah, I know. And he's brought her, and she sat out in the audience and listened. And it was, we didn't bring her to the actual recital for obvious reasons, but it was really special to have her there. And it always continues to be special to play when she's in the audience.
What is your advice to a young musician who aspires to have a career like yours?
Learn how to hear no. I think that's an important one for all professions, but music especially. I know we didn't really get into it in this discussion, but learn what imposter syndrome is and learn how to move past it. Learn how to recognize your strengths for what they are and not compare them to the strengths of others. Don't be afraid to ask your colleagues and your friends and your mentors questions.
That's wonderful. Allison, thank you so much for joining us on Double Read Dish. This was so wonderful. We are so grateful for you spending your time.
Thank you again. It was so nice to be here.
We hope you enjoyed that wonderful talk with Allison Nicotera and that you'll rate and review on Apple Podcasts. I'm going into my NPR voice.
Okay, Terry Gross.
Okay. So that's all we have for you for this program.
Follow us on social media and Galit, who are we talking to on our next program?
We went from NPR to Yokel Radio.
No, program is proper, right?
No.
Program. It's
program.
I know it's program, but I feel like if you're posh, you say program.
That's like you're saying pilgrim.
Like schedule. Isn't that a schedule. Posh way to say it?
Sure.
Okay. Who's on the next episode?
Next episode, we had the absolute pleasure of speaking with Dora Proud, assistant professor of oboe at the University of Idaho, and very soon to be oboe faculty at the North Carolina School of the Arts.
You all are going to pass jet streams on your cross-country moves.
Yep, sure.
All right, well, have fun with that. I'll be watching Housewives and cuddling my dog.
Jackie, let's end this nerd parade.
Go make reads.